When we talk about God being faithful, what do we mean?
Trustworthy.
That's right. He keeps his promises. That's correct. And so, how long can we be patient in waiting for God to keep those promises? Do we lose faith? Back in chapter 22 of Genesis, we read about Abraham demonstrating his confidence in the faithfulness of God when he was told to take his son and to offer him as a sacrifice, chapter 22. And so, in chapter 22 and verse 9, he came to the place of which God had told him, built the altar, arranged the wood, bound his son Isaac, laid him on the altar, stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. Hebrews, the book of Hebrews, tells us why he was willing to do that. This was his son of promise. Why was he willing to do that? That's exactly what the book of Hebrews says. He trusted in God that even if he killed him, God would raise him from the dead. Why was it necessary for God to raise Isaac from the dead?
Son of promise.
Son of promise. God keeps his promises. And that text in Hebrews, he's writing to Christians who are suffering. Back in chapter 10, verse 32 is where that section begins. And here they've become Christians and they're suffering. And what that whole section is about is how do I persevere in the face of suffering, trial? It's not just believing God is. That won't do it. Verse 6 of Hebrews 11, most of you memorized since you were children. Do you remember what it says? Without faith, it's impossible to please God, for believe that He is, and
He's a rewarder.
He's a rewarder of those who seek Him. God keeps His promises. And it's that faith that drove Abraham and Sarah and Jacob and Moses, as you read through that chapter, that God's faithful, He keeps His promises. We're in chapter 46 of the book of Genesis. And Jacob has learned, we see that at the end of chapter 45, this very stunning fact that his son Joseph is alive. And he was convinced by the objective evidence of the wagons and the testimony of his sons, and came to believe that Jacob was alive, that Joseph was alive, though he had not seen him since he was 17 years old. So you can believe in something you cannot see. You can believe in something you do not personally experience on the basis of evidence. Yes, sir?
It's interesting that this incident also proves to him how he was deceived and lied to by his sons back whenever Joseph was.
Right. Yes, it shows that to Jacob. And of course, there's a lot that's not said. I know that. But there's no indication of Jacob then turning in vengeance on his son. That's a good point that Ennis makes, though. How must the father have felt to find out that his boys have been lying to him for 22 years? That's the case. But, so Jacob has learned now, and Joseph wants him to come to Egypt. That's where chapter 46 begins. So we look here at 46:1. So Israel set out with all he had and came to Beersheba, this is in Canaan, and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob, he said, here I am. Have you ever wondered what that sounded like? I do. The Spirit said to Philip, go join the chariot. I wonder what that sounded like. I don't know. Interesting. Anyway. He said, I am the God, I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. Okay. God is faithful. Let's stop and think for just a moment. Go back to Genesis 12, your Bible. Look at verse 2. You know this verse. God makes this promise to Abraham. I will make you a great nation. Okay, so here God is telling Jacob, his grandson, I'll make of you a great nation in Egypt. Obviously, you in Genesis 12:2 means what? Is Abraham a great nation? Out of Abraham, his descendants, right? Make of you a great nation. Okay. Now, so, when you read Genesis 46, has that promise been fulfilled?
No.
It has not. Where is it going to happen?
In Egypt.
In Egypt. Okay. So, look at how old Abraham was in Genesis 12 when this promise was made. How old was he?
75.
Okay. We're back to... Aren't y'all be glad this Genesis class is over and all these calculations? And so Genesis 12. All right. Now, he was 75. How old was he when Isaac was born? Huh? 100. So 25 years have passed, right? Great nation yet?
No.
How old was he when Isaac was born? I mean, how old was Isaac when Jacob was born? We don't work on that one as much, do we? 60, right? So now 85 years have passed. Great nation yet?
No.
Not yet. We're going to learn a little bit further if you go over in our reading today, Genesis 47, verse 9, how old Jacob is now. Genesis 47, verse 9, he's 130. So, if you add those three figures, 25, 60, and 130, how many years since God made the promise? 215 years. Still no great nation. 215 years. But we're not finished. How long did Jacob, here in chapter 47, how long did Jacob, verse 28, live in Egypt? 17. So 215 and 17, 232 years, right? Great nation yet?
No.
No. And so, I don't know exactly the time frame as to when you get to Exodus chapter 1, because it says another Pharaoh arose, another ruler over Egypt, who didn't know Joseph, and thus the oppression. But you'll note in Exodus 1:5, he mentions what we're reading in Genesis 46. Moses, the writer of both books, as we know, Genesis chapter 46 and verse 27, it tells us how many people went to Egypt. 70, right? Look at Exodus 1:5. All the persons who came from the loins of Jacob were 70 in number, but Joseph was already in Egypt. So Joseph is included in the 70. But the 70 people that make up the nation from Abraham, through Isaac, through Jacob. But now look in verse 7. The sons of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly and multiplied and became exceedingly mighty. Wouldn't it be enough to say that one time they became fruitful, for example? Wouldn't that be sufficient?
No.
while the synonyms, synonymous phrases, emphasis, for emphasis, focus. The nation is really, really growing. And so, by using these synonymous phrases, he calls attention to that. But it's not only in that verse. In verse 9, he said to his people, "Behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we." From 70 people. Now, whether this is a hyperbole, an exaggeration, I don't know. But it's enough to have gotten the Pharaoh's attention. More than the Egyptians, most powerful empire on the earth at that time. More and mightier than we. Verse 12. The more they afflicted them. Remember, Moses is writing, same one that wrote Genesis. He said, the more they multiplied and the more they spread out. Then in verse 20, God was good to the midwives, so the people multiplied and became very mighty. Moses preached a sermon later about their history. Where is that recorded? What? Well, he did write the song, 90, but he preached a sermon. His sermon is recorded. Deuteronomy. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 26, verse 5, in his sermon that he preached before he died. This is before Israel crossed the Jordan into the Promised Land. Of course, Moses was not allowed to go. But he preaches this sermon to the people. In Deuteronomy chapter 26, verse 5, "You shall answer and say before the Lord your God, my father was a wandering Aramean," that's Jacob. "He went down to Egypt and sojourned there, few in number. And there he became a great, mighty, and populous nation." We've been tracing this all the way through Genesis, isn't it? We see it moving into the book of Exodus and setting the stage for what happened in the book of Exodus. If that promise had not been fulfilled and they had not become a mighty nation, would you be reading about the plagues?
No.
Because Pharaoh, people were crying for deliverance from oppression. When they first moved to Egypt, what was their condition? What was their life like?
Blessed.
Very, very great. Yes, very good. They got the best of the land. Pharaoh's attitude was favorable to it, but things had changed. And things had changed, especially been heightened, because they had become so many of them. Populous. Great nation. Now, great nation also looks at a couple other things, but right now we're looking at population number. And so in our reading here in Genesis 46, when you read verse 3, and that's a significant statement, and just remember how much time has passed. And is there any indication Jacob does not believe that?
No.
Like his granddad and like Isaac, and the promise was made to all three, he believed God keeps his promises. There's another statement made back in Genesis 12, verse 7. He says, "To your descendants I'll give this land." This land being what?
Canaan.
Have they got that yet?
No.
Well, Jacob lived in Canaan. Wouldn't that be the fulfillment of the promise? No,
it
was not. And so, you're going to give this land to this great nation. So they get to Egypt, and how long were they in bondage?
400
years. So they do become a great nation, but they still hadn't got all the promise. But finally, God brought them out using the plagues and a particular event that came to be one of their feast days called what? Passover, which they were to remember the rest of their days, in which Christ now is our Passover, signifying our redemption. So they're now brought out of the land, brought over to the land of Canaan, where they conquer their enemies, and that promise is fulfilled. And so you see, again, God keeps His promises. And when He writes to the Hebrews, whoever wrote that book, in the face of their trials and difficulties, He makes mention of men like Abraham and Sarah and said they were strangers and sojourners on the earth. Now, while Abram believed God would keep the promise of a land for his descendants, what does the Hebrew writer tell us that Abraham had ultimately in mind? What was he looking for? A better country, a city, a heavenly city. And so that's what enabled Abraham to face all these trials. He believes God keeps His promises. And if we are going to make it through life, when we face difficulties and disappointments, we have got to believe God keeps His promises. And so there's value in studying the book of Genesis and seeing how God has demonstrated through history that indeed He does, even though it may not be obvious. And there may be things that are happening that we cannot explain, we don't understand, like the story of Joseph. But that was a means through which God determined to keep His promises. So I'll make of you a great nation there. Now verse 4, I'll go down with you to Egypt. What does that mean? So as they went to Egypt, they got in the chariot, started riding along, God sitting in the other seat. He's going to bless them. He's going to protect them. He's going to provide His grace with them. The only reason I mention that is we immediately know the meaning. We don't even stop to think about it. But it's not that God in His person would be there right beside them. Not that he could see God. It's just a promise God makes. So we pray for God to be with us. God promises to be with us. What are we asking for? We're asking for His favor, His blessing, His provision, His protection. And that's what God promises him. And I will surely bring you up again. And I'm not sure what God had in mind in that statement. It could be talking about resurrection and eternal glory. I'd kind of doubt it. I rather think he's talking about bring you up again, refers to his descendants. I'll bring them back to the land of Canaan. You remember you'll see when we get to chapter 50 that, well, at the end of our reading here today in chapter 47, look at chapter 47, verse 29, right at the end of the verse. He pled with Joseph. He said, please do not bury me in Egypt. When I lie down with my fathers, you shall carry me out of Egypt, bury me in their burial place, burial place of his fathers. And Joseph swore to do that. Over in chapter 50, we'll see that Joseph, verse 24, told his brothers he was about to die. But God will surely take care of you and bring you up. Bring you up. Very similar terminology. Bring you up from this land to the land which he had promised. So some of you have more insight than I've got on that. Bring you up again. Share it with me.
I actually thought it was talking about, when I read and I put all that together, could be wrong, that it was talking about that the very thing that he asked Joseph to do, bring up, don't leave him in Egypt, but take him
back. And that very well could be bring you up again, bring after you die, could be bring your descendants back to Canaan. And I'm not saying it couldn't be talking about heaven, but I don't know that. I really don't know. But anyway, it's an interesting statement.
And Joseph asked the same thing, that he not be left in Egypt.
Yeah, and there it's very clear. Don't leave my remains here. So that's why Linda says that may be what Jacob had in mind. Okay, so Jacob arose from Beersheba with the sons of Israel, carried their father Jacob and their little ones and their wives and the wagons which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. They took their livestock and their property which they had acquired in the land of Canaan and came to Egypt. Now you have both in verse 6 and in verse 7 a little word that's significant. It says, Jacob and all his descendants. Same thing in verse 7, and all his descendants. Now, so that the reader, not only the people that Moses is writing to, but all posterity, might understand that, then he gets very detailed in the section that follows by talking about who these all are. So you start in verse 8. Now the names of the sons of Israel, Jacob and his sons who went to Egypt. And then if you start counting in verse 8 and include Jacob, what you're going to have when you get through verse 15, these are the sons of Leah. And you're going to have 33 names in verse 8 through verse 15. 33. Okay. And then starting in verse 16, you start looking at those names. And what I've done in my Bible, I put little numbers beside the names so I could keep track of them. But anyway, you start in verse 16 and you go through verse 18. These are the sons of Zilpah. You see that in verse 18. These are the sons of Zilpah. So he's categorizing all these descendants by the birth mother, Leah, and then Zilpah, the handmaid. And here you have 16. So you have 33 and you have 16. And then in verse 19, he starts with Rachel. And when you get to verse 22, you have another similar phrase. These are the sons of Rachel. And so verse 19 through 22, Rachel and her sons and grandsons, you got 14. So, how many are we at? 14, 16, and 33? 63. So now you start in verse 23 and go through verse 25. You see in verse 25, these are the sons of Bilhah. And you got 7. So 33 and 7, there's your 70. So he said he brought all his descendants, he listed them, and then you get verse 27 at the end of the verse, they were 70. Now, in verse 26, you have this statement, all the persons belonging to Jacob who came to Egypt, his direct descendants, not including the wives of Jacob's sons, were 66 persons in all. But I thought he said 70. Well, these, the 66, who were the ones who came at this time, four of them were already there, weren't they? And so you got, well, if you count Jacob, not there were three there, and then you count Jacob. You got Jacob, Joseph, and Joseph's two sons, that's four. And so then you get your 70. But that's how you can reconcile verse 26, verse 27. There's another issue here. If you look at Acts chapter 7 and verse 14, if you're familiar with Acts, you know that we're reading a sermon preached by a man named Stephen. You've probably studied it. You may remember, you may not. Stephen seems to be a Grecian name. And since he's already worshiping God with the Jews, that indicates he was what you might call a Hellenist. So why am I mentioning that? Because that's interesting when we're going to look at this verse that we're going to look at. So Stephen is doing the preaching. And he's preaching to a Jewish audience. But a Hellenist, the Bible they might use would be what? If you were, what does it mean when you're when you say in the New Testament they were Hellenist? It does point to the idea of Greek. It's the idea that adopted. They might be worshipers of God, but they had the Greek customs and so forth. Okay, Jews could be Hellenist, and so. The Bible that was often quoted in the New Testament, the Greek Bible, was what? The Septuagint. If you're reading the commentaries or other books, you'll see LXX. Everybody knows what LXX is, right?
70.
70 translators is the idea. And that's the Septuagint. Now, here in Acts 7:14, Joseph sent word and invited Jacob, his father, and all his relatives to come to him. 75 persons in all. Wait a minute. I thought it was 70 persons. Those who want to undermine the credibility of the Bible, can you see what they do with this? The Bible doesn't agree. Here's a contradiction. Often, maybe every time, but often when these fellows who write these supposed contradictions, what they actually betray is their ignorance. But be that as it may, in the Septuagint version, here in Acts chapter 7, they list one son and one grandson of Manasseh, two sons and one grandson of Ephraim. How many is that? Five. There's your 75. Now, whether that's the solution to this dilemma or not, I can't be certain, but that does make sense, and it would provide a very reasonable explanation. What heightens the fact that Stephen didn't make a blunder? That's probably not a good question. If I wanted to talk about geology, and I wanted to talk to Matt Innan about geology, What I want to be careful not to do if I want to retain my credibility? Not make an obvious blunder. Right? So that'd take a lot of work for me. But anyway, so if I made an obvious blunder, it discredits to some degree what I'm talking about. What kind of audience does Stephen have?
Jewish audience.
If this was such an obvious blunder in contradiction to the writings of Moses, what would have happened to his credibility? It was not viewed, evidently, as a blunder. But those people were familiar with the Septuagint. So whether that's the answer or not, they didn't take it that way. And so if you happen to be reading Acts 7, you say, wait a minute, I remember we studied in Genesis 46. There, that's one of the possible explanations that seems to me to make sense to reconcile this difference. Did you have a comment?
Question. I just want to make sure. In Genesis 46, we're talking about direct descendants of Jacob, correct? And then over in Acts 7, it says, Joseph sent word and invited Jacob, his father, and all his relatives to come, 75 persons and all. Could it not have been Jacob and his four wives?
Some think it is wives, and that's another possible explanation that I ran across when I was working on this. Down in verse 26 of Genesis 46, it says, not including the wives of Jacob's sons, but that was one way to count it, and you can actually come, like you said, Keith, to that very idea. So that's another possibility.
Well, here it's talking about, in Genesis, it's talking about direct descendants. So anybody who came directly from Jacob. So it's talking about sons, grandsons, all that stuff.
That would include the ones that the Septuagint lift. Manasseh and Ephraim and their boys.
Over here, I'm talking about Jacob's wives. So the five here, the number in Genesis is excluding Jacob and his four wives, right?
Well, four won't.
Two wives and two handmaidens, two. Moms?
Yeah, if you count it that way, that's another way to look at it.
Not trying to bog the class.
No, that's okay. I ran across the idea of wives and that concept. Actually, another angle on it, but we're not getting into that, on the wives. What I'm saying, there's ways to explain this that are very reasonable.
Rachel is dead at the time, though.
Yeah. Well, I'll just mention it, but let's just leave it at this. There were 12 boys, and so Reuben's wife was evidently dead because, remember, he went and married Shua. And then, of course, as Linda's mentioned, Rachel is dead. Simeon's wife may have been dead. He married a Canaanitess. I don't know. Whether or not you count that, some count it, some don't. What I'm saying, when you figure it up, you can get down to 9 boys. So you got the 3 wives, those 3 women, and then 2 more. So anyway, you can do it that way. It's kind of complicated. Actually, and I didn't want to get to it in class. But anyway, I'm glad you mentioned that. That's another way to work it out. So y'all work it out and let me know, will you? Okay. And that's good. When you're running across a text like this, this is a challenge for you to do some study. Say, let's see if I can figure out what may be going on here. And so Moses, obviously, in writing this to the people he's writing to, they would know whether or not this is accurate. And then Stephen, preaching to a Jewish audience very familiar with this, they would know whether or not he was correct. We're 2,000 years removed from Stephen's sermon and 3,500 years removed from Moses' writing. So we've got to be very careful in our judgment of these things, that there may be certain ways that they counted genealogy that we're not familiar with. So good observations. I could answer you better, Keith, if I go read my notes, but I don't think you want me to do that. Okay. So you got these 70 people that go to Egypt. And in verse 28, he sent Judah before him to Joseph to point out the way before him to Goshen. They came to the land of Goshen. Joseph prepared his chariot and went up to Goshen to meet his father Israel. As soon as he appeared before him, he fell on his neck and wept. That must have been quite a meeting. 22 years had passed. He was just a boy when he was sold, and now he's the ruler of Egypt at 39 years old. And so Israel said to Joseph, "Now let me die, since I've seen your faith that you're still alive." And so Joseph said to his brothers and his father's household, "I'll go up and tell Pharaoh, and will say to him, my brothers and my father's household who were in the land of Egypt have come to me. And the men are shepherds, for they've been keepers of livestock. They brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. And so when Pharaoh calls you and says, what's your occupation? Go ahead and tell them." Now, is there a statement right at the end of 34? Remember that big bucket I've got up here? It says, "Every shepherd is loathsome to the Egyptians." I went and tried to find out why. You know what I found? Several opinions. I don't know why. That's what I'm saying. I don't know why. There's several suggestions that have been made. Again, if you figure that out, you let me know. But alert. Is that somebody who wants to answer that question? All right. So, but be that as it may, they were to be put in the land of Goshen, which we'll see in a moment, was evidently a very good land for those who would take care of flocks of sheep. And so, chapter 47, Joseph went to Pharaoh and said, "My father and my brothers and their flocks and their herds and all that they have come out of the land of Canaan. And behold, they're in the land of Goshen." Okay, so Pharaoh asked him about what they did, and they told him about being shepherds. Verse 6 of chapter 47, "The land of Egypt is at your disposal. Settle your father and your brothers in the best of the land." That's interesting, isn't it? The best of the land. "Let them live in the land of Goshen. And if you know any capable men among them, then you put them in charge of my livestock." Why they were loathsome, so you have to say, wait a minute, not because they didn't care about livestock. He had livestock. I don't know why. Was it they considered them a lower case? They're just down here in the social status? I don't know. But be that as it may, was it because they offered these animals as sacrifices? I don't know. Yes, sir?
I don't know the reason, but it's very interesting in God's providence that the Pharaoh offered them the best land. That would be, I guess, conducive to what they're doing as shepherds. And you find, far removed from that time, 400 years when you get to the Exodus, how the people of Israel are separated from the land of Egypt. So that the plagues come on Egypt, but not on the land of Goshen.
Good point that Craig makes. Y'all hear that? They're put in the land of Goshen, a good land, adapted to their occupation, and then when the plagues come, that particular land is is accepted from the judgments. Good point, Craig. Glad you brought that out. It's interesting to me how well they're treated in spite of the fact of the statement that Moses made. These kind of people are loathsome to the Egyptians. Look how well they're treated. Obviously because of Joseph. Because of the high regard that was held for Joseph. Yes.
I think it's interesting that Moses brought up this very subject when he was telling Pharaoh we need to go, when it was time for the Exodus, to go sacrifice to God. Pharaoh said, go sacrifice to God, but don't leave the land. Moses then said it would be loathsome to sacrifice, I guess, the lamb or whatever they were going to sacrifice to God in Egypt.
Okay.
And so he says we need to go someplace else to sacrifice.
Okay. Interesting observation. All right, so Jacob blessed Pharaoh. What he said, what he did, I don't know. But evidently conveyed his sense of favor toward Pharaoh. And that's when he asked him how long he had lived. And that's, here's one of our time stamps. It's interesting in verse 9, he said, few and unpleasant have been the years of my life, nor have they attained the years that my fathers lived during the days of their sojourning. So Abraham lived, what, 175? So indeed, he didn't live as long as his fathers. And he's had all the heartache that he's had with the situation with Laban, the situation with Dinah and the Shechemites, the situation with Joseph for the last 22 years. And so that's been on his heart. So Joseph settled his fathers and brothers and gave them possession of the land of Egypt in the best of the land. We have that in verse 6. We have it again in verse 11, the land of Ramses. Now, verse 13, now it says in 12 that Joseph provided his family with all the food they needed. When you start in verse 13, you look in verse 15, he's going to be talking about the Egyptians. See verse 15? All the money was spent in the land of Egypt, and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph. And so, as you start reading this, this is an account of the Egyptians. When you get down to verse 27, Israel lived in the land of Egypt and Goshen. They acquired property. You're going to see in verse 20, verse 13 up to that point, the Egyptians actually ended up selling their property to Pharaoh. It seems like, unless I'm missing something, that when you get to this point, actually, Israel is being treated better than even the Egyptians. But that's an interesting thing. So anyway, so what Joseph's plan was, we have here in verse 47. Joseph gathered all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan for the grain which they had bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. So when the money was all spent in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, give us food, for why should we die? He said, our money's gone. Joseph said, give up your livestock and I'll give you food for your livestock, since your money is gone. So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them food in exchange for the horses and the flocks and the herds and the donkeys. And he fed them with food in exchange for their livestock that year. Then when the year was ended, they came to him again the next year. And again, they said, there's nothing left. And so Joseph, they said, buy us and our land for food so that we may eat. So Joseph bought all the land for Pharaoh. I've got a question on your lesson. I'm out of time here, but look at the question on your lesson, number 4. When the famine continued to be so severe that the people ran out of funds, rather than the government simply doling out food supplies, what did Joseph... Oh, got a missing word. What did Joseph do so the people could provide for themselves?
The first year they traded their cattle for bread.
But after that...
Their land and themselves.
Their land's gone. Now what did he do?
He moved them to...
Just say, come on up here to the welfare line. We'll give you food.
No, they gave one-fifth of the...
Oh, it's Pharaoh and
one fifth of what? They don't have anything.
Oh, he gave them seed.
He gave them seed. He said, "Go sow it. Go work. Go work." Now, when you get a harvest, 20% tax. What are we going to do? So instead of just putting them in a welfare line, he said, "Here's some seed. You go work. You go sow. You'll make enough, and then 20% you'll give to Pharaoh." So I just thought that was interesting as we went through it. Okay, we're out of time. The Lord willing, we'll finish up on Wednesday. Do 48, 49, and 50. Three chapters. Okay? Thank you.